Since life on land is so utterly dependent on life in the sea, we can safely deduce that a dead sea means a dead planet. The ocean is as round as the earth, landlocked in every direction, with thousands of inlets, but not a single outlet. Waste and refuse are littered everywhere, and we try to sweep it all into the ocean as if under a carpet. Anyone who has drifted from one continent to another on a bundle of reeds or on a log raft cannot help being struck by the fact that the ocean is just another big lake. Only a fraction of this water needs to be polluted to kill all life.
Norwegian anthropologist and explorer Thor Heyerdahl, of Kon-Tiki and Ra fame, talking about man's abuse of the oceans, visible so clearly to him in his legendary raft expeditions. Thor Heyerdahl was one of a series of distinguished lecturers who spoke during the Stockholm meetings on the human environment, and whose lectures were edited for broadcast by Radio Canada International. Thor Heyerdahl on the oceans.
Quite recently, it has become more and more apparent that some of the changes man is imposing on his original environment could be harmful to himself. In fact, they could even lead to global disaster. What are we building, and what are we doing to our environment? Can this unorganized rebellion against nature, this global building without plan, continue at its rapidly increasing pace without the haphazard structure collapsing over our heads? Is there something we can do to safeguard our existence in the changing world? Are we on the verge of destroying something that we ourselves and our descendants cannot do without? Indeed, the problem is manifold, since civilization is complex and the world is large. It is my privilege here to raise some questions pertaining to one aspect of the problem. What are we doing to the ocean? We of the 20th century AD, in spite of our supermarkets and superjets, have not become supermen who can cut off the navel string to nature and survive alone as an independent species. We must never forget that we are part of a tremendously complicated system, part of a synthesis of biological species, ranging from the oxygen-producing plankton of the sea and forests of the land to the food-producing soil and water, which can yield their indispensable supplies only through the activities of insects, worms, and bacteria, inconspicuous creatures which man, in his ignorance, usually disregards and even despises. Not even the invisible creator, call him God or call him the force of evolution, could place man on the surface of the earth until all other biological species were already there to support him. Only in recent years have we begun to understand the interaction of the extremely complex ecosystem where every single biological species has its function in creating living conditions, birth, and continued survival for other species higher up the ladder of evolution. On the very top of this ladder, man is balancing, ready to fall if for some reason he should lose the support of the species that preceded him and paved his road to existence. More than half of the biological pyramid supporting man at its apex is composed of creatures living in the sea. Remove them and the pyramid collapses. There will be no foundation to maintain life on land or in the air. We are all aware of the fact that an important part of the human food supply comes directly from the sea. In fact, modern economists are counting on a vastly increased output by ocean fisheries if we are to solve the growing problem of feeding the undernourished world of tomorrow. If we kill the plankton, we lose the fish and thus drastically reduce the protein available for human sustenance. Man can limp along with very little in his stomach, but he has to fill his lungs. It takes weeks to die of starvation, days to die of thirst, and seconds to suffocate. If we kill the plankton, we reduce to less than half the supply of oxygen available to men and beasts. And this at a time when forests are becoming scarcer than ever before. We, like all breeding species, will in fact be increasingly dependent on the plants in the ocean, since green landscapes rapidly recede before the spread of urbanization, industry, and the onslaught of modern farming, while asphalt, concrete, and barren sand dunes advance on previously fertile land. Since life on land is so utterly dependent on life in the sea, we can safely deduce that a dead sea means a dead planet. Let us humbly admit it. If man is to survive, the ocean is not dispensable. If it is not dispensable, a pressing question naturally emerges. Is the ocean vulnerable? If we ask the man in the street, if we ask the decision makers, if we ask ourselves, we are likely to hear the answer, the ocean is not vulnerable. It is too vast to be damaged by little man's activities. It is an enormous self-purifying filter which has taken care of itself for millions of years and will continue to do so forever. We are all familiar with the phrase, a drop in the ocean. Since the morning of time, thanks to gravity, nothing has dropped off the Earth into space, nothing except a few truckloads of gear recently transferred to the moon. Millions of years with natural pollution, millions of years without human industry, when nature itself was a giant workshop experimenting, inventing, producing, and throwing away waste. Waste by incalculable billions and ever more billions of tons of rotting trees, dead flesh, bones, excrement. Whether we measure in weight or in volume, the wastes of all the world's industry amount to nothing during the few decades of our technical era as compared with the hundreds of millions of years of volcanic eruption, global erosion, and untold generations with death and decay. Man is not the first manufacturer. Why should he become the first polluter? Our spaceship is built with an ocean to take care of pollution, so why worry? Why can't we pollute when nature can? Simply because the pollutants of modern man have suddenly become basically different from those of nature. Like nature, we have started to manipulate molecules. We have started to understand some of the most ingenious inventions that preceded our own existence. But when we take molecules apart and put them together in our own way, we get, to our own surprise and delight, new and amazing substances never invented by nature, although they appear to be highly useful to man. Plastics, DDT, and an endless series of other effective insecticides, detergents, and chemical products hitherto unavailable on planet Earth. Why had nature overlooked the usefulness of these inventions? A sheer oversight? Today we can really get our laundry white and can exterminate every trace of insect life. We spray leaves and trees, fields and swamps. We spray bugs and worms, bees and butterflies. We spray into the air and down on the soil. We wash and we spray and flush the detergents down the drain. We mass produce. Industrial plants grow like temples around cities and lakes, along roads and rivers. Toxic wastes seep into every stream, pour into every sewer. Rain and drainage and man-made sewers carry pollution away into the sea. The mighty currents of the ocean churn around and carry away all poisonous waste. Carry away? No, carry around. The ocean is as round as the earth, landlocked in every direction, with thousands of inlets, but not a single outlet. Why cannot the oceanic filtering system function for technological man as smoothly as it's functioned in the recent decades of our parents, or in the days of ape men, monkeys, and dinosaurs? Cannot all refuse, now as before, be reused as fuel for the biological machinery? No. And this is precisely where the environmental problem has begun. Man has recently created materials which nature wisely avoided because they had no place among the perfectly interlocking cogwheels of the global ecosystem. Through technology, man has begun to throw extra bolts and nuts into a ready-made and smoothly operating machinery. Although it has only begun with our own generation, year by year, day by day, man's production of non-transformable, non-degradable materials has increased in a virtually precipitous curve. Waste and refuse are littered everywhere, and we try to sweep it all into the ocean as if under a carpet. We realize that an increasing quantity of our modern waste is both toxic and non-degradable, but it doesn't matter. The ocean is endless. The ocean is deep. This is, in fact, the second misconception. For the ocean is not endless, and its depth is greatly misleading. Just as we have seen that the age of the ocean is no guarantee of its invulnerability in technological times, in the same way we shall see that its size is no better guarantee. Anyone who has drifted from one continent to another on a bundle of reeds or on a log raft cannot help being struck by the fact that the ocean is just another big lake. Only a fraction of this water needs to be polluted to kill all life. Marine life is concentrated near the surface. And again, most of the surface life is concentrated near the shores. Why is only the upper limit of real importance to marine life? Because marine life, directly or indirectly, depends on the plant plankton as basic food. And plant plankton can live only where the sunlight can penetrate the water in sufficient quantity to permit photosynthesis. This upper section in the sunny tropics is only 80 to 100 meters deep, whereas in the northern latitudes, on a bright summer day, it has a depth of only 15 to 20 meters. Below this thin layer, life is immediately very restricted, since it depends on the sinking of decomposing plant and animal remains from the sunlit waters above. Why again is most of this surface life further concentrated near the shores? Because marine plant life, in addition to sunlight, needs mineral nutriment. In the coastal areas, some of these are brought down by rivers, and others are returned from the bottom of the sea. The ocean bottom is rich in these nutrients, which have rained down from decomposing organisms near the surface, and they can only return to the surface in areas where strong underwater currents and upwellings occur, such as near continental shores. What is so dangerous that we are afraid of storing it on land, we dump overboard, guided by the principle out of sight, out of mind. As an example, incalculable quantities of poison, including entire shiploads, have both openly and secretly been transported from industrial countries in Europe in recent years to be dumped in the presumably bottomless North Sea. This sea is so shallow that at certain points the depth is only 13 meters, a little more than 30 feet. And during the Bronze Age, half of the North Sea was dry land. Much has been written for and against the American Act, repeated by others, of dumping vast quantities of nuclear waste and obsolete war gases in the Atlantic with the excuse that it was all sealed in special containers. There are already enough examples in shallower waters like the Irish Sea, the English Channel, and the North Sea of similarly foolproof containers with harmful contents, moving a boat with bottom currents and cracking open, with the result that millions of fish are killed or mutilated. In the shallow Baltic Sea, 7,000 tons of arsenic were dumped in cement containers 40 years ago. These containers have now started to leak. Their combined contents are 3 times more than needed to kill the entire population of the Earth today. It may be difficult to find means of stopping ocean pollution from seepage and sewers, but deliberate dumping in the sea of material too dangerous to keep in sight should be considered a criminal act. It could easily be forbidden, and the offender should be most severely punished under international law. In fact, there is no such a thing as national waters. The ocean is in constant movement. Only the solid ocean bottom can be mapped and divided between nations, not the mobile water above it. If you launch a raft off the coast of Peru, it will be carried with the currents to Polynesia. If you set a reed boat afloat off the coast of Morocco, it is carried to tropical America. This illustrates that there is no such a thing as territorial waters for more than days at a time. What are territorial waters of Peru today are territorial waters of French Oceania tomorrow. What are territorial waters of Morocco now will shortly become territorial waters of various states around the Caribbean Sea. Even though it is extremely important to put an immediate end to deliberate ocean dumping, this is only part of the problem. By far the greatest quantity of toxic refuse constantly reaches the sea in a much less spectacular way from agricultural fields and urban and industrial sewers. To visualize the immense quantities of solid and dissolved waste and fluid chemicals, of all kinds, which every minute flow into the ocean from the shores of all continents, we should imagine the ocean without water as a big, empty depression. The fact that every river in the world empties into the sea without causing an overflow makes us subconsciously think of the ocean as a sort of witch's cauldron whose contents never come to the brim, no matter how much is poured in. We are apt to forget that the ocean has its own sort of outlet, the evaporation from its surface, which permits only pure water to escape, while all our poisons, all our solid and dissolved wastes, are left to accumulate forever in the pot. Visualize then the ocean as a dry and empty valley, ready to receive only what man is pouring in. The rising level of toxic matter would clearly be visible from all sides. Even the tallest chimney in the world sends their pollutants into the ocean. The densest city smog and the darkest industrial smoke will slowly be carried away by the wind only to descend with rain and snow into the ocean. Cities and industries are expanding day by day, and so far in America alone, waste products in the form of smoke and noxious fumes amount to a total of 390,000 tons of pollutants every day, or 142 million tons every year. The ocean is the ultimate sink for all pollution disposed of in modern communities, even what we try to send up in smoke. It is common to think of ocean pollution as waste thrown overboard from thousands of ships, or a spectacular accident with an oil drill springing a leak, such as in the Santa Barbara accident, or a supertanker running on a reef, such as the Torrey Canyon in the English Channel. It is not the spectacular accidents that hit the headlines that should scare us most, but the daily, intentional, almost inconspicuous discharge of crude oil from Navy and merchant ships all over the world, above all, the routine cleaning of oil tankers. It was therefore a blow to us on board the raft ship Ra to observe from our papyrus bundles that entire stretches of the Atlantic Ocean were polluted. We drifted slowly past plastic containers, nylon, empty bottles, and cans. Yet, most conspicuous of all was the oil. First off the African coast, next in mid-ocean, and finally in front of the Caribbean islands, we drifted for days on end through water, reminding us more of a city harbor than of the open sea. The surface, and as far as we could see through the waves, was littered with small clots of solidified black oil, ranging in size from that of a pinhead or a pea to that of a large potato. When we repeated the same general itinerary with Ra 2 the following year, in 1970, we carried out a day-by-day survey and found sporadic oil clots floating by within reach of our dip net during 43 out of the 57 days the crossing lasted. 43 days out of 57. And in this time we had covered 3,270 miles or 6,000 kilometers of open sea from Safi in Morocco to the Caribbean island of Barbados. With our sail, we moved faster than the floating pollution. And since the equatorial current runs westwards with an average speed of half a knot into the birthplace of the Gulf Stream, the flotsam we passed en route from Africa to America in 1969 was, during our second crossing a year later, washed ashore in tropical America, or else displaced more than 4,000 miles and thus drifting on its way back towards Europe across the North Atlantic. The tourist industry is concerned about the oil washed up on the beaches, but it is time to get more concerned about the oil washed against the inaccessible rocks. Maybe the oil clots gradually sink, but so far they certainly are only accumulating, disclosing their presence and leaving their effects in an ever more conspicuous way. Fishermen have already begun to notice a grayish belt, darkening from year to year, just above water level on coastal cliffs and boulders. Particularly in the eastern and southern Mediterranean, and on several of the local islands, the yellowish rock is becoming discolored from yellow to gray and even black in a belt 6 to 8 feet wide. In many areas, this belt along the waterline, once covered by seaweeds, clams, mussels, limpets, and all sorts of crustaceans and small fish, is now dead, completely sterile. Nothing undulates or darts about. The once yellow rock seems like coke, and in many places, sizable clots of oil are hammered into the pores like spots of tarmac. And this is happening in what is the cradle for the bulk of marine life, since most species have to pass one stage of their life cycle on the rocky shores of islands and continents. We hardly need to be reminded of the fact that even a drop of liquid oil will spread out over a large surface area of water, and the thicker the film of oil, the less is the photosynthesis and the production of oxygen. In spite of all this, it is not the floating oil clots we should fear the most. Their presence shows us that our planet is not endless and that visible human waste is beginning to bridge world oceans. The oil clots in the sea tell a similar story to that of the refuse on the beach. Visible pollution is seen by some as a symptom of welfare. If we want to bless its presence, however, it should be as an eye-opener. Each empty plastic bottle or tube, each can, each oil clot we see along the roadside or on the beach should ring a bell and make us think of invisible pollutants already lost in the soil or the sea, liquids and particles not discernible to the naked eye. Man does not dispose of empty packing only. It is the lost contents and not the empty containers which should worry us. Where is the spray, the paste, the powder, the liquid no longer inside the empty packings? I appeal to the multinational representatives in Stockholm to put aside all immediate personal and national interests and to be aware of the immense responsibility they have towards present and future generations. Let us hope they bear in mind that the ocean currents circulate with no regard for political borderlines, and that nations can divide the land, but the revolving ocean, indispensable and yet vulnerable, will forever remain a common human heritage. I thank you.
This lecture by Norwegian anthropologist and explorer Tor Heyerdahl was one of a series of distinguished lectures delivered during the Stockholm meetings on the human environment and arranged by the International Institute for Environment Affairs with the support of the Population Institute. The next speaker in the series is Gunnar Myrdal, Swedish economist and author. These lectures were edited for broadcast and made available by Radio Canada International.